But first to the corals of the Great Barrier Reef, which are also in hot water. A survey this year from the Australian Institute of Marine Science reported huge areas of bleached coral on the reef. Corals can regenerate, but the frequency of climate events is severely testing their ability to bounce back. So reef scientists are searching for new ways to build resilience. David Weckenfeld is the chief scientist at the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority. Earlier this year, he spoke to a climate adaptation conference about projects to protect the reef.
The Great Barrier Reef is enormous. At 344,000 square kilometres, it is bigger than two-thirds of the countries on the planet. And that represents an enormous challenge as soon as we start talking about pushing the boundaries of adaptation into any kind of ecosystem intervention or restoration. It is also enormously diverse, not only in the many tens of thousands of species that inhabit it, but also the various habitats that they make and live in. And that diversity presents another challenge if we are talking about intervention or restoration. How much of that diversity do we think we can restore or intervene to protect? This will come as no surprise, but the Great Barrier Reef is enormously valuable. It is a fundamental part of the national identity of Australians. It is recognised as a World Heritage Area. It is an international environmental icon. And it's worth a lot of money. The direct financial activity on the Great Barrier Reef is worth billions every year to the Australian economy. The overall ecosystem goods and services are worth tens of billions, and the park supports tens of thousands of Australian jobs. And it enormously frustrates me every time Australia or Queensland experiences an extreme weather event, I'm told of the insurance cost of that event. Well, we don't have an insurance policy on the Great Barrier Reef. So the damage that is done to the Great Barrier Reef by heat waves, by cyclones, by floods, is simply not factored in to those economic impacts. And therefore, the economic impact of climate change is much, much higher than what we are regularly told. Now, we have been saying for many years that there are four major threats to the Great Barrier Reef, but in the last few years, it has become abundantly clear that climate change is by far and away the greatest of those threats. There are many elements of climate change that threaten the Great Barrier Reef, but it is these top three that are the greatest, and it's the extreme events that are the problem. So marine heat waves, severe tropical cyclones. We are now up to 10 severe category tropical cyclones that have impacted the Great Barrier Reef since 2005 alone. And increased flood severity is also impacting the reef. Now, I mentioned that the reef is huge and I mentioned that it is diverse. There is a lot of bad news out there about the reef. That's understandable. But much of the reef is still beautiful, vibrant, diverse, valuable, and it is to be treasured and it is to be protected. I don't want anyone to lose sight of that. But increasingly, more and more of the Great Barrier Reef looks something like this. This is the impact from Cyclone Nathan in 2015 on one particular reef. But coral bleaching, cyclones are increasing the proportion of the Great Barrier Reef that is in a degraded state. Now, these areas can certainly still recover if we do the right thing in terms of global mitigation of climate change and local actions to improve resilience. So what does that actually look like? Well, we know that in recent years, the condition of the Great Barrier Reef has been in overall decline. But as those tasked with the management of the park and the protection of the Great Barrier Reef, we are trying to deliver the upper of those two trajectories. In other words, we're trying to stabilise the decline and give the reef a chance to adapt to climate change. We are trying to avoid the lower of those two trajectories, which we have seen happen in many places in the world. So that's not just theory, that's what happens to a coral reef if you push it too far with too many impacts. There are two things that are critically going to determine which outcome we get. Obviously, the first is the rate and magnitude of climate change, but then the second is what do we do locally to improve the resilience of the system? And our traditional approaches have been to reduce human impacts on the system through marine park management, fisheries management, and coasts and catchment management. In summary, these mean fulfilling the objectives of the Paris Agreement, and I have to stress that 2 degrees is not good enough for the Great Barrier Reef. Well below 2, maybe 1.5, we're actually starting to talk about a Great Barrier Reef in a situation that is manageable. Remembering the impacts we already have are at +1, +1.5 is going to be worse, but we think manageable. But increasingly, we are thinking about the topic of this session today at this conference. What do we need to push the boundaries, to go beyond traditional approaches? What does the next generation of adaptation and marine park management look like on the Great Barrier Reef? And that is the subject of a growing collaboration in adaptation between scientists and marine park managers. After the 2 consecutive years of mass coral bleaching, we held a reef summit in May, almost exactly a year ago. 70 national and international experts, traditional owners, tourism operators, conservationists, scientists, fisheries experts, and marine park management experts got together for a 2-day summit. And the output of that summit was our reef blueprint. The mood in the room was surprisingly optimistic. There was a strong sense of commitment. There was a feeling that together we can secure the future of the Great Barrier Reef, but we need to try harder, do more, and act now. I'm not going to go through everything on this, but essentially the output of the summit, the blueprint, identifies 10 key initiatives. Some of these are about strengthening things we already do. Some of them are about doing things completely new. What I really want to focus on for the rest of this talk is controlling crown of thorn starfish, protecting keystone species, and facilitating restoration, as well as building a resilience network. These are the areas where we have decided to focus on pushing the boundaries of adaptation. So I'm going to talk about 5 quite specific case studies. These by no means cover everything that we're doing in the adaptation space, but I think they give a good flavor of the diversity. And then I'm going to talk about the reef restoration and adaptation program after I talk about those case studies. As I move through the case studies, I'm going to start with ones that are not R&D. We're doing them now. They are part of adaptive management of the park. And I'm going to move through to case studies that are really more about R&D. We are not doing them as management now, but they're tools that we are developing because we feel we may need them into the future. So Rain Island, it's a tiny little speck of sand. You wouldn't think it was very important. It's way up in the northern Great Barrier Reef, but it is the world's largest green turtle rookery. So it is critically important to that keystone species for the Great Barrier Reef, and indeed, it is critically important for green turtle populations globally. You'll notice that there's a ring of sand around the outside of the island, but in the middle of the island, there is a hard phosphate cap. In many places, the transition from the beach to the phosphate cap is a gradual, gentle slope, and the turtles can maneuver across that transition very easily. But in a lot of places, that transition is a steep cliff. Now, it's only 1 meter high. You or I could step over it without too much problem. But for a 200-kilo turtle, it represents an almost insurmountable problem. If they're on the upper part trying to get to the lower part, they tend to fall over that cliff. Generally, they land on their back, and they're stuck. A 200-kilo turtle cannot right itself. We typically get many tens to low hundreds of mortalities from this every year. And I want to stress, as far as we know, this is a natural process. This is just part of the life of being a turtle coming to Rain Island to nest. Another problem that the turtles face on Rain Island, and we're not sure the extent to which this is natural or in some way perhaps linked to climate change, but much of the habitat that the turtles used to nest, the sand is not deep enough to protect them from the water table. And so on a high tide, the water rises through the island, inundates the nests, drowns the eggs. And we've seen this lead to very low hatchling mortality in recent decades. Even though we know that it's a natural process, we've decided to intervene to stop the turtles going off the cliffs. And we've simply erected pool fences. The pool fences direct the turtles away from the dangerous transition areas to those areas that are safer, where there is a smooth slope from the phosphate cap to the sand. And we've seen the mortality rate fall from many tens to just 1 or 2 per year. Again, although the mortality there is a natural process, we are trying to adapt to and offset other impacts to turtle populations from climate change. We've brought in heavy machinery to reprofile the sand on the island. Essentially, we've taken areas of very deep sand and areas with very little sand, and we've flattened it out. We've created much more successful, suitable nesting habitat, and as a consequence, there's less inundation of the nests and higher successful hatchling emergence from those nests. And this reprofiling, you can see we've just done this as an experiment on one section of the beach, has lasted over several years. So it is a sustainable, ongoing solution to the problem. I want to emphasize, this is a World Heritage Area, and we're bringing in heavy earth-moving machinery to reprofile a beach to help a keystone species recover and survive future impacts of climate change. Most of the rest of what I'm going to talk about is corals and coral reefs. So crown of thorn starfish are a predator of corals. Outbreaks of the starfish are one of the three main causes of coral mortality on the Great Barrier Reef, the others being cyclones and coral bleaching events driven by marine heat waves. We're marine park managers. We don't control the weather, but we can control the starfish. We have for many years used the techniques at our disposal to protect economic assets, in other words, reefs of the highest value to the tourism industry. But with scientific advances that allow us to kill the starfish much more efficiently than ever before, and a better understanding of the ecosystem and how it works, we are actually now talking about protecting ecological assets. Now, not all of the 3,000 reefs that make up the Great Barrier are equal. Some of them might have a lot of coral, that coral might spawn, but the spawn might end up drifting off into the coral sea and never ends up anywhere that coral can grow. Other reefs on the Great Barrier Reef, when they spawn, they're connected to 50, 60, 70 other reefs. In other words, they are absolutely pivotal to the overall process of the reef recovering and maintaining as a coral-dominated system. So those are our key ecological assets, and that is where we're now focusing our crown of thorn starfish control. Into the future, we're actually also looking at reducing the spread of outbreaks. Now, this is a bit of a conceptual diagram of the boom and bust population of the crown of thorns. So the top line is the coming and going of crown of thorns outbreaks. And not surprisingly, the coral, the prey of the crown of thorns, follows a lagged boom and bust cycle as well. Now, at the moment, we're in the middle of an outbreak. We have many millions of starfish on the Great Barrier Reef. We can't kill them all, and we're not trying to. But by focusing on that resilience network, the reefs that make more of a difference to the overall health of the system, we believe that we're protecting key ecological assets and improving the trajectory of coral overall on the Great Barrier Reef. Into the future, we are hoping that when this outbreak diminishes and eventually the next outbreak starts, as it most likely will, we will be able to suppress or contain that outbreak and greatly reduce the amount of coral mortality. Now, I want to stress both this and the Rain Island example. This is not R&D. This is actual marine park management today. It's informed by science, and we're continuously adapting these approaches. But this is what marine park rangers are doing in conjunction with the tourism industry right now. I'm now going to move into stuff that is more R&D. We are not doing these things that I'm going to talk about next as marine park management yet. This is actually a photograph from the Philippines taken by Dr. Peter Harrison from Southern Cross University. Peter's technique is to harvest coral larvae either from the ocean or by taking adult corals into the laboratory and keeping the larvae in captivity. And essentially by doing that, he has a much higher survival rate than would happen in the wild. There's no predation, there's no disease, there's no death from insufficient oxygenation because all of those things can be controlled. He then has many tens of millions of larvae that he can use to reseed the reef that those larvae originally came from, but he can deliver much higher recruitment rates. This area in the Philippines in the photograph was completely denuded of coral by blast fishing. In a five-year period, these are the colonies that you can see have grown from a reseeding event 5 years ago. At the moment, Peter's only focusing on doing this one species at a time, but obviously our hope is that we can develop these techniques, do it for multiple species, and do it at much bigger spatial scales. And that is the key challenge on the Great Barrier Reef. Its enormous size means that anything we consider as an adaptation technique to push the boundaries, unless we're only going to use it for site management, we have to be able to scale it up. But this holds enormous promise for reseeding reefs into the future. Another R&D line of investigation is assisted gene flow. The Great Barrier Reef spans 14 degrees of latitude. The north is much warmer than the south, and the northern corals have got a much higher level of thermal tolerance than those in the south. We know that if we take northern corals and deliberately move them southwards, they can better cope with extremes in the thermal environment 1, 2, 3 degrees further south than, if you like, their home reef. We might do this with adult corals, but more likely we're going to connect this with Peter Harrison's work and do it with the larvae, because we can move billions of larvae big distances quite easily. Now, we're not doing this yet. There are risks associated with this, but we are refining the technique so that this could be a management tool into the future. Pushing the boundary even a little bit further, scientists at the Australian Institute of Marine Science are investigating different options for increasing the speed of evolution of corals. Now, corals hybridize naturally. So different species, egg and sperm, will mix and produce viable colonies. What we're finding in the laboratory is if we do this deliberately, the hybrids, first of all, grow faster, but they are also more thermally tolerant. And we're trying to investigate whether this could actually be something that we accelerate as a process in order to help corals adapt and evolve to future climate change. Again, only happening in laboratories at the moment. Aside from investigating assisted evolution of the coral animal, we're also looking at assisted evolution of the microscopic algae that live inside the coral. Now, this has an advantage. The generation time of the algae is much faster than the generation time of the coral itself. And this allows us to essentially stress test those algae. If with each generation we raise it at a higher temperature in the laboratory, with each generation the thermal tolerance gets a bit higher. And if we introduce those into wild populations, we think we would have the ability to increase the thermal tolerance of the symbiosis between the coral animal and the algae that lives inside it. So each of the things that I've spoken about so far is a relatively small-scale, moderately funded research project in its own right. But we've worked in partnership with the Australian Institute of Marine Science and those other partners whose logos you see at the bottom to develop something called the Reef Restoration and Adaptation Program. This is looking to take adaptation and restoration research on the reef to a whole new level. Not individual projects anymore, but an integrated, multi-institutional, multidisciplinary program looking right across social sciences, economics, governance, as well as biophysical sciences to deliver against those three objectives on the screen. It's about protecting the values of the park. It's about delivering techniques at scale and that can be logistically delivered at scale, and also that can be affordable. These are the three critical considerations for any strategy that is actually going to work. So we're currently in a $5 million scoping and development phase for this, but just a week or two ago, the government also invested another $100 million for making this operational and beginning to deliver on this program. Now, I just want to stress this is a concept. It is not actually the basis of any rigorous risk assessment. It's on the basis of me moving some little squares around on a PowerPoint slide on a plane yesterday. So don't anybody quote me on this. But much like Hugh was saying, there are a range of tools at our disposal. Each of them comes with a risk and a consequence of potential adverse outcome as well as potential positive outcome. And I just want to say, if you look at those things on the slide, we're talking about more things than I've spoken about. In particular, we've got cloud brightening. So we've got geoengineering on the list. People are proposing geoengineering for the Great Barrier Reef. It's my job to protect the Great Barrier Reef. I'd really like to stay in the top left. Pretty confident it's going to deliver a positive outcome. Very confident it's not going to deliver an adverse outcome. But I know that climate change is changing that risk equation. And the question for us is, where do we draw the line? And as time goes by, depending on which climate change trajectory we follow, where are we going to decide that something is too risky and we're not going to implement it versus something else where we think the cost versus potential benefit ratio is worth it? I want to emphasize that's not a real risk assessment, but this is the thinking we're going to need to do over the next 10 years as we decide which tools do we take out of R&D and do we put into implementation. So these experiences with real-world R&D adaptive management raise a number of issues, so a number of biophysical issues. We have to make sure that these things are not a distraction from mitigation. These are not an alternative. We have to mitigate. We have to deliver on the objectives in Paris. There is a consideration that it's difficult to make things worse, but some of the solutions are risky in their own right. We need to be very careful to manage risk. We need to think about what do we mean by restoration. We are not going to deliver a Great Barrier Reef that is as it was in 1975 when the Marine Park was declared. So which of the values and the ecosystem functionings are we focusing on for restoration? And what is the biophysical feasibility of different strategies to deliver on different objectives? Overall, we want to follow a less is more principle. We do not want to intervene any more than is absolutely necessary to keep the Great Barrier Reef as more or less as we know it and functioning as a coral-dominated system. We don't want to intervene any more than we absolutely have to. That means we might do R&D to develop tools that we never use. I think that's okay. We need to keep our options open and over the next 10, 20, 30 years, pick which tools to use. There's a whole raft of social and economic considerations, and this is just a selection. But again, the Reef Restoration and Adaptation Program is as much about these social considerations as anything else. Traditional owners are very familiar with managing country, but we need to talk to them about what is and is not acceptable in managing sea country, because we are in the process of changing what that looks like. Hugh spoke about governance. Who controls who makes these decisions for the future? Are our current governance systems sufficient or not? And in particular, what balance do we want between facilitating new ideas, pushing the boundaries, new interventions, versus more traditional regulation to protect the values of the ecosystem? And what's the social license to operate? What will the people of Australia, and indeed the world, accept in terms of innovation in adaptation on the Great Barrier Reef? And underpinning everything is funding. So about a week ago, the government invested a further $500 million into protecting the resilience of the reef. It's a very bold new funding mechanism. They're putting $440 million of that $500 into the Great Barrier Reef Foundation, which is a funding body that funds science and conservation, but critically is well connected to philanthropy and private enterprise. And the notion is to develop a public-private partnership where the government investment will leverage further investment from the private sector to deliver an overall bigger bucket for resilience management on the reef. So I just want to finish up by emphasizing something. I've been here to talk about pushing the boundaries, but none of what I've said changes the fundamental premise that we must tackle climate change globally and we must work to the most ambitious side of the Paris Agreement. The traditional techniques that we use to protect the park are essential, and we must continue to adapt those and improve them as best we can. And all of the new ideas, the pushing the boundaries, they are going to be critical over the next 10 or 20 years, but they sit on top of everything else. They're not alternatives. We need to grow the toolbox and do all of this if we want to protect the Great Barrier Reef into the future. Thank you.
You've managed to answer almost all of the questions on my iPad here. But you mentioned the funding towards the end there, and I guess what people are really wanting to know, you know, is that funding going to be enough? Are we going to get what we need? Where are we at with that funding?
It's difficult to answer the question, will it be enough? Without question, it's an enormous step forward. So that funding goes across most of the major threats to the reef other than climate change itself. So it addresses water quality issues, it enhances crown of thorn starfish control, it invests in restoration and adaptation, and it invests in better compliance with marine park zoning. So it is a very important package. It is very timely. It will make a big difference to what we can achieve. That funding is for the next 6 years. I guess there's some big uncertainties. So the reason why the is it enough question is hard. The intent with the funding is to leverage private investment. We don't know how much private investment we're going to leverage. So that's a key to will it be enough. The other thing is, as Hugh said, the impacts of climate change are already coming faster and harder than we were anticipating. I remember when I first thought about the impacts of climate change in 1998, I felt reasonably relaxed because I thought, well, this will be somebody else's problem, but I'll be happy to educate people about what's going to happen in the future. I never envisaged we were going to be talking about restoration the way we are now in my career. I thought it would be something for the future, if at all. So I don't know what climate change is bringing. I don't know what the next set of extreme weather events will be. I don't know how the reef will respond. I don't know how we will respond. The whole paradigm of managing the marine park is becoming much more dynamically adaptive than it ever was before. And I think that even if I say, yes, it's enough for today, that doesn't change the fact that we're going to need to manage and adapt dynamically, and we may need more in 4 years or 10 years' time.
So you've talked about we're already at 1 degree and we already have quite a bit of existing stresses on the reef. So we've really only got that half a degree of headroom. Are we going to make it? I mean, do you lie awake at night thinking, is there any point in what I'm doing?
I don't lie awake thinking, is there any point? Because I know there is a point. I think we need to remember that although I work to protect the Great Barrier Reef, coral reefs globally provide coastal protection, food, and income for hundreds of millions of people. And most of those people are the poorest people in the world. So I see the Great Barrier Reef, if you like, as a poster child for the reefs of the world. If we can use the Great Barrier Reef to help leverage global action on climate change, it will save the livelihoods, the food source, the coastal protection of hundreds of millions of the world's poorest people. So I think it's critical. So I don't lie awake at night wondering whether there's any point. There is a point. I do worry about whether we're going to, where we're going to land on the spectrum from 1.5 to heaven only knows how much climate change. The advice from the world's coral scientists is that reefs will tolerate +2 in the short term, but if we want to avoid global collapse of reefs, we're going to need to bring it back to +1.5. And so we get back to geoengineering, carbon capture, solar management and so on, radiation management. These are obviously global questions that go well beyond the management of the marine park, but as much as it's uncertain where we're going to land, I think we have to work as hard as we possibly can because coral reefs are so valuable to so many of the world's peoples. We have to do everything we can.
David Wackenfeld is the chief scientist of the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority. He was speaking to Sarah Bolter at the Climate Adaptation Conference, which was held in May this year in Melbourne.